Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to episode number 34 of the Everything Coworking Podcast. I am super excited to get started with today's guest, but before we do that, I want to talk about the 30th Annual Global Workspace Association Conference coming up September 28th through the 30th in Las Vegas at the Four Seasons. Check out the website for the details, conference.globalworkspace.org. We have a fantastic lineup of content and speakers. I'm super excited. We have Peter Scala, COO of Delos Solutions. They do the Well Building Institute. They have partnerships with the Marriott and a number of other folks. Really excited about this trend that we're seeing in Third Workspace Trend Panel, along with Nick Levine from Verizon, who will talk about how Verizon is looking at their corporate real estate portfolio and share more about their relationship with Grind, who's doing co-working spaces under the Verizon brand right now in New York. Another speaker I'm super excited about is Bill Dowser, principal at BVN, which is an architecture firm based out of Australia. They do really innovative work in shared workspace, and Bill is a real student of shared workspace. They've worked out of every WeWork in New York so far and do some work with Liquid Space and is just really at the forefront of the thinking about what's going on in shared space design. So more of that, a number of great panelists, and we're also really focusing on breakout sessions that can really help you get business knowledge and takeaways to run your business better when you go home. So check out the conference website, conference.globalworkspace.org, and get your early bird tickets before those prices go up. We'll see you there. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to get to chat. I've heard you speak a couple of times at a couple of work techs in New York and San Francisco, and then a Workplace of New York Association meeting a couple of weeks ago. And then I think I'm going to see you in Portland for a really unique IFMA event, or Workplace Evolutionary event, I think, which is part of IFMA at the Nike campus. I'm super excited about that. So I'm really intrigued about the work that you do, especially in the context of what's happening in shared workspace. So you do a lot of work around multisensory design. So I'll give kind of my interpretation of your background and then let you do an intro and fill in the gap. So you're trained as an architect, but really now are focusing on the human aspects of space. And you've done a lot of work in the US and Europe around workplace design and helping real estate strategy and helping, I assume, corporations understand what kind of workplace innovation looks like today and what the human experience is in those spaces, not just kind of what the design can do. And you run a company called Plastark, which does that work. So tell us a little bit more about you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. First, I do have to confess I enjoy speaking. I'm also a bit of a proselytizer. I'm dedicated to being out there and sharing what we know and what we're learning from working with organizations around the world about the occupant experience and the importance of space for people. So we're constantly out there really trying to show the evidence for why workplace really matters from a human perspective, from a health and well-being perspective, from a people performance and business perspective. So speaking both in this podcast as well as in public and conference and events really seems to be a great platform for getting those messages out. As you mentioned, I am trained as an architect in architecture school, both undergraduate and graduate. I learned, among other things, that art is really differentiated from architecture by occupancy and the fact that it's a form that's intended to accommodate occupancy and really human occupancy. So we think of architecture as the art and science of occupancy, and I've spent my career really focused on transitioning from what one might think of as the science of the technical world of the built environment, the building systems, the structure, the things you learn about in architecture school typically, with what is really the part of the building that matters from our perspective, which is the person, the human, the social, the cultural, the interactions between people that are made possible by that space that's carved out by architecture. So that's really the exciting piece for me and for the team that I founded about 4 years ago and are really focused on consulting, as you mentioned, to generally corporate occupiers, organizations that have enough people and space where researching and making sort of workplace policy-based decisions, thinking about the design not just from a one-off, but from many instances of an environment where it really makes a difference because of the size of their portfolio or the significance of their workforce, either because they're highly paid or because there are many of them. That said, we consider work environments to be any space where people work, whether you're thinking about the hospital that the nurse is working in or the educational environment that a teacher is working in. When you've got a work environment where you've got a worker and a space, you all of a sudden have architecture and interior design that is part of the economic equation. Part of the performance of the worker is the space itself. And so that's where we can start to build a business case and really look at the economic value of the physical environment. So that's really where we hone in terms of the kinds of work environments and the kinds of environments that we focus on from an architectural perspective.
Yeah. And so Melissa and I were chatting a little bit before I hit record about this interesting time that we're in workplace, which is sort of, this is starting to be thrown around as a more common term, but the consumerization of workspace, where, you know, your examples that you just gave around sort of business cases for corporations or hospitals or people who are looking at the ROI of, you know, how do you get better productivity or engagement out of people by making their work environments better? And then, you know, now we're looking at a scenario or an evolution of workplace where people have choices about where they work, either because they're working for themselves or on contracts or because their employer is giving them the opportunity to choose either, you know, the corporate office or a third space, you know, home or a co-working space or other type of shared workspace. So the consumer is really starting to vote around what's important to them mm-hmm. and what makes them most productive, which I think it's such an interesting time in workplace because that data will start to emerge and people will be sort of voting with their wallets around what they prefer and what's important. And from a shared space perspective, I think we're, you know, just sort of barely getting to the point where we're ready to be thinking about those things. And yet it's so important. And the consumer is going to probably get there before we do. You know, we've been trying to figure out what's the optimal layout, how many phone. So Melissa's at WeWork today and she's in one of their phone booths. You know, how many phone booths do you need? How many meeting rooms and what's the right ratio and size and common areas and, you know, do you do coffee or beer, all of those types of things. But your work really gets into kind of this whole other layer of things that we don't necessarily, I think of as being really explicit, but is very implicit to the experience in a workplace. And I'd love to have you kind of walk through that framework and talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, excellent. So I'll actually mention a couple of things before we jump in there. One is that, you know, folks have come to us for a long time as people who are focused on qualitative and quantitative evaluation of space and said, you know, how do you really judge if a space is good or not? And how do you mm-hmm. figure that out? And we've been saying for a long time, you know, but before this more recent term of the consumerization of space, that spaces that are highly occupied are in some way better serving the people if people are choosing to be in those environments, and spaces are maybe less serving or need improvement in design if they're underutilized. And so often we've seen underutilization or high utilization has been a reason to cut square footage or to cut footprint or to resize a portfolio. But we really see it as more of an indicator, a litmus test about what spaces are people being drawn to, attracted to, and then what can we learn from those about what people want, and what are the spaces that, you know, are continually being unoccupied, and how do we quickly transform those so that they're better serving the occupant group? We've talked for a long time about sort of fail-fast facilities management and how you should be experimenting and testing new ideas and getting them out there. and letting people, your customer, your occupant group, test it out. And if they use it, then it's working. And if they don't, then you swap it out for something else. And I think one of the things that we've learned from co-working and serviced office, who've been forced to be more customer attentive and customer centric than maybe typical corporate occupiers, is that they have been doing that experimentation. They've been investing more quickly and iterating more quickly on various designs. And then, of course, WeWork is sort of the pinnacle of that, in part because they've grown so fast, they've been able to test new ideas much more quickly. But to get to your point, as you were mentioning, we have been using this kind of design construct of multi-sensory design in part as a way of describing some of the things that we're discovering and learning from looking closely at co-working environments. As I mentioned, our research ranges from the quantitative in nature to the qualitative in nature. And we do a fair amount of work, which we describe as workplace anthropology, which is really going in and getting to know an organization and sort of their indigenous environment, living with, learning from them, seeing how people use space, and really balancing the information or the data that we might get from a survey or an analytical report from what we see is people's actual behaviors. And there's so much that we can learn, whether it's about how people work around a certain challenge in the environment, or as we were discussing previously, what spaces people choose to use over time and how that would inform the work environment design. So when people ask me about our methodology, I often say that we quite simply use a kindergarten science project approach to things. You know, we make an observation, we formulate a question, we build up a hypothesis, we think, why is that happening and what are some various ideas? We develop a methodology and we go out and test and experiment. And we come back and we write a report and make some recommendations and repeat that over and over again. So kind of as a follow-on to that, we've started to use this idea of a way of thinking about design at a contemporary moment when we have to be so much more focused on the occupant, and we're really talking about the user experience of space more than planning or design was thinking ever before. And so similar to this kindergarten science approach, we're kind of taking the next step forward and using just our five basic senses as a way of talking about how we're thinking through the workplace experience. And of course, if you dive deeply, you'll see that humans have many more senses than just the basic five, but the basic five are a nice way of talking about how we experience workplace. Another element of that is we say, and it's even more relevant now that we're talking about fitness devices, sensors in the work environment, but really to think of people as sensors who are constantly using all of our sensorial capability in order to understand our environment. And that's happening at a very basic level in terms of making sure that we're safe and comfortable and keeping us out of risky environments. And it's also happening at a more philosophical level of wanting, or social level of wanting, to connect with others in space, as well as looking for signs of how we are perceived by others, how we are understood by our organization. All of these things that we're looking for an understanding of, both practical or functional and social or environmental, those are all going on at the same time. So we're these highly tuned sensors, and we're stepping into an environment and we're going to be dialed into all of those things. So obviously, architecture and design have been focused on the visual sense for quite some time. You can tie that back historically to photography and really to drawing and photos being the primary way of representing architecture and design to date. And so, of course, the visual or sight is the first sense that we talk about, but also to recognize it, it's more than that sense of composition or the visual appeal of the space. There's also the aspects of sight, which are thinking about glare, thinking about the way that our eye takes in daylight and the difference between the daylit experience and the artificially lit experience. So our eye, you know, sight is a sense, but our eye is really taking an incredible incredible volume of information, and that that's also impacting our bodily experience at a wellness level as well. The next sense that we talk about is that of smell. Smell, as many people likely know, is the sense that is most closely connected to memory. And it's really a great way, from a design perspective, to connect to a customer, to have this great kind of pairing of a visual experience with an experience of smell. It's also, from a design perspective, it's something that is really being exemplified by some of the hotel providers. Many retail organizations are also either have established a scent brand associated with them, or they're working on something like that. And so it's definitely something that we see coming to the workplace as a way of connecting with a customer to have that experience of the space. Smell can also do a lot for us in terms of relaxation and aromatherapy, really being not just for the spa environment maybe, but also for work environment, to really be able to activate all of those senses is important.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. This was really interesting to me because I just not thought much about smell in the workplace, but I was staying at the W when you did this presentation in New York a couple weeks ago. And I remember you get in the elevator and you're like, oh, I'm at a W, because the elevator smells like the W, which is a funny thing to say. And it's sort of subtle, but I had recognized it. And it's such an interesting brand experience. And for the workplace, it makes a lot of sense. And on your presentation, you have a little image in the bathroom, which is sort of a funny thing to talk about. But for shared space owners, the bathroom is always sort of a big deal. Like, how do you sort of manage that experience? And there are actually providers that are starting to work on this and provide, like, you know, custom scents, just like the W has, for shared workspace and corporations, which I think is so interesting, and connected to apps, so you can kind of dial up and dial down and choose which one you want playing at a certain time, which I would guess there are some don'ts in that realm. Just like with music, people probably have some strong preferences, but if managed correctly, can be a really interesting experience for the user.
Yep, absolutely. So just as you might be thinking about the design of anything else and how colors or textures are informing the occupant and their experience, their feeling about something, the scent is going to do exactly the same thing. You can really go very deep in this research. You can look at how the difference between how citrus smells inform our behavior, put us in a certain mood, or that of floral smells. So there's really a range of ways that we can design and not engineer, but really anticipate or evoke certain user behaviors and sensibilities through the smell of the environment. And just as you're saying, that it's really about shifting the idea of the workplace that we're designing from a place that someone is mandated to come to, you know, your job and your job description includes sitting at a cube in an office, to really saying the office design is about making a place that people are going to choose to come to even when they have lots of other choices and options, and even when they've got to travel to get to that place, that they're going to still make it a priority because it's giving back something to them. It's an enjoyable environment. It's a place of social connection. So, you know, this is all kind of happening both in the context of thinking about co-working and the consumerization of space, but also, you know, the world of corporates trying to attract people to their environments. We've got an economy relative to talent attraction and retention right now, which is challenging to many organizations that haven't been thinking about how to make their work environment appealing and make it a place that people want to come. And that's more and more being seen as a driver of attraction and retention and having the best people, because people want to come to a place that's going to be giving back to them and fulfilling experientially, which is probably a nice segue to taste. So certainly organizations like Google and others have set a precedent of employee expectations around what might be part of an office experience from a nutritional perspective. It's well known that a lot of organizations, increasingly Silicon Valley and tech organizations, have a strategy of, you know, get them to the office and keep them at the office. And one of the ways to do that is to feed people breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But really, from a bigger picture perspective, if we just take the taste as a sensation or as a way of stimulating an environment, you have a whole range of aspects to think about from a design perspective. So certainly the practical of being able to provide space that would allow for catering, would allow for proper nutrition, thinking about from a serviced office perspective, stocking with healthy and flavorful foods, foods that stimulate us and give us nutrition. I also think that this connects back to the idea that we're bringing more ritual and more social interaction into the space. Mm-hmm. And so building community through bringing people together, maybe even making that community around preparing food together, maybe experiencing one another's cultures by bringing the flavors of those things to work, or even just thinking from a wellness perspective about the value of staying healthful and it being as important to use calories in the work environment is to consume those calories. So lots to think about in terms of the taste or the flavor that we might bring to a workplace.
And the coffee, of course.
And the coffee, of course. I think that is interesting because part of what is stimulating about coffee is the caffeine, and part of what's stimulating about coffee is the intensity of its flavor. So it is one of the things to think about if you're stocking either, you know, an honesty market, or you're thinking about what foods are going to be available to people in the work environment to keep them stimulated and engaged. You kind of do want to think about what is that palate, right? What is the crisp apple versus the potato chips? Mm-hmm. And you can really go so much further by thinking about those strong flavors and kind of stepping away from the traditional caloric sources.
Yeah. And I was thinking as you said that, I mean, I have a real passion for wellness, which is why I got into co-working, because I wanted to create that culture of well-being in the workplace. And we see that a lot. There's a space in New York that I visited when I was there a couple of weeks ago that is very focused on kind of the well-being platform. Mm-hmm. But also from an attracting people perspective, if you want people to feel alert and productive while they're in your space, you want to be careful about what you're offering, because if they're eating cupcakes and bagels all day, they're not right. going to have that feeling, even if that's what they think they may want. So it's interesting to sort of think about it, you know, just from that, whether it's good for them, but also like what experience do they have in your space if that's what they're consuming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly, you know, as you were saying, as we're looking at that consumer experience of the environment, particularly in co-working or serviced office, but now more and more in traditional corporate, is that when someone has experienced your space and maybe a week later they're thinking to themselves, am I going to go back to that space? Do I want to be there again? They're putting that whole experiential package together in making that decision. They're putting together who they spoke with, if they could find a power outlet, what they had to drink, what it smelled like. They're packaging all of that experience into a choice about whether or not to go back. And so if we're thinking about workplace design from a user experience perspective, and we're looking to have the spatial equivalent of attraction and retention, then absolutely we have to think about every moment of that experience and every sense that has been piqued in the process.
Yep. I love it.
So the next one is sound, and that's really something that, you know, we've heard so much about in the work environment. A lot of the work around, you know, introverts and extroverts in the work environment and who's more distracted by sound issues or less, and, you know, topics of if you open up your work environment but then everyone puts on headphones, is it really more collaborative? So sound is a really powerful thing to think about. And I would say by and large, it is something that has not been effectively considered in design in the workplace and even in architecture. There is so much of what is determined by architecture that is powerful in relation to the sound or the acoustic experience. The materials, the surfaces, even surfaces that look the same can be categorically different from an acoustic perspective. And so that's really something that you want to be addressing at the design phase. Then certainly certainly beyond the initial or the architectural design, there's then also the opportunity and really the demand more and more that there is an acoustic experience. So kind of in the early days of architecture, there was no acoustical design. And then as HVAC, which are the air handling equipment in an office, have become quieter and quieter and smaller, we've then kind of gone into the design of white noise or gray noise or pink noise to recreate background sound in open office environments in particular. And then sort of the next generation or the next wave is really to think about not just sound masking, but really to create a soundscape or a kind of music or sound landscape within an environment that matches the design of that space. So you're really using the sound of an environment that might be playing on an acoustic system to enhance the experience that you're trying to create, whether that be one of respite and relaxation, or a space that's intended to be energizing, or a space that's intended to enable concentration. So really, again, as a designer, you can be thinking sort of holistically about this experience. As we've been saying all along, these are things that the retail and hospitality providers have been thinking about for a while. Another thing that we do think it's important to talk about here is that, you know, we often get questions about the generations and the millennials versus Gen X versus the baby boomers and, you know, what their expectations are in the work environment, with an assumption somewhat that, you know, just more mature people are looking for enclosed offices and this kind of thing. And so we do find it important to say, in the context of the multisensory work environment, that people's senses actually change over time and change as they age. So an older adult is going to have more difficulty distinguishing between different types of sound in the workplace and the distance between things. So they might have a harder time hearing someone who's nearby versus inadvertently overhearing someone that's further away from them. So there are some of the things that we talk about in the context of generations in the workplace that are as much driven by our physical acuity as anything else.
Makes sense.
And then, of course, you have a whole new landscape of people who, you know, simultaneously working on potentially multiple mobile devices while they're in their work environment. And so a kind of layer of what is the public acoustic experience that's with the space versus what is the individual acoustic experience that someone's adding within their workplace. And I think that that's just a layer of this kind of consumerization and individual choice that we're getting. And I think that the general objective is going to be to provide an acoustic environment that people will want to have their headphones out for.
Right. Right.
But to recognize that people also can use acoustics as a way of carving out space within a space that might not be readily accessible otherwise.
Where do people start if they want to fix the sound in a space?
I can honestly highly recommend the services of an acoustician or an acoustical engineer. Mm-hmm. Another one of the things that we talk about is that all of these senses come with a set, sometimes several, quantifiable measures, right? So just like we typically measure real estate in square feet and inches, often only square feet and inches in a horizontal plane rather than also looking at a Well, I think more and more we'll see that real estate could be sold volumetrically because ceiling height makes such a huge difference to one's experience. But that's a total aside. Anyway, there are units of measurement of all of these senses. Okay. So for smell, there's something called olfs, and it's really the total amount of the smell. Smokers generate more olfs than non-smokers, for example. So there's really a lot more measurability of this than the general population might think. Furthermore, as a result, there's also much more capability to model something than most people think. So just the way an architectural designer can create a rendering which shows how the light is going to reflect on various surfaces and show you how beautiful the wood surfaces are going to be and how, you know, really show you the visual experience of a space. An acoustician or an acoustical engineer is similarly able to model how a space will sound based on size of the space, based on the materiality. You can even now, you know, work with a designer that can allow you to put on a pair of headphones and hear what a space will sound like.
That's interesting.
Persons, a rock band inside of it. And so that technology is totally there. And I think it's one of the things most worth paying for as a client of design because it's scientific, right?
So yeah. Really, and that was the one where I felt like it doesn't at least lends itself to your kindergarten science approach. Like I was thinking, you know, I was thinking, oh, if someone wanted to sort of DIY and make some improvements, you know, I could think of a number of ways they might experiment. But the sound piece is one of the most stressful pieces of a space. And right, I think the hardest to get right as a pedestrian.
Yeah. So there's actually a pretty good publicly accessible document on this published by the GSA. That's the General Service Administration, who are responsible for real estate for all the federal government workplace. And it's a book called Sound Matters. It's a PDF publication and accessible to all. And it really goes through, I think, a good mix of designer and layperson understanding of how controllable acoustics really are. And I think that because we can't see them, we've imagined that they're without management. Mm-hmm. But really, every step of a design decision is as much impacting the visual experience as the acoustical experience. And it is something that if you're using a design team that's not focused on that, that's a challenge. That said, and back to experimentation, I think one of, again, the successes of co-working organizations is they've been able to solve typical acoustic problems in different ways. So, for example, a typical way of solving for an acoustic challenge of something like the phone booth that I'm in right now is to create a very tight seal on the door so that sound can't go in or out. And that's an expensive way to handle it because getting a tight seal on a glass door is expensive. And so co-working organizations such as WeWork have put phone booths in hallways or less utilized corridors or up against spaces where it's okay if some of the sound from my phone booth goes out into the adjacent hallway. And generally no one is spending significant amount of time in that space. They're walking through it. So I think one of the interesting things about the kind of fast build and experimental of co-working has been that they've found different ways of solving those typical challenges. But again, either one of them can be a good point of collaboration with an acoustic engineer.
Got it. Makes sense. And I will link to that Sound Matters publication in the show notes, which will be on the website at everythingcoworking.com. That sounds like a great resource.
Excellent. And then we've got just one more sense to cover, and that is the sense of touch. Really, this idea or the sense of either with our fingers, being able to physically touch something, or with other body parts. You can imagine kind of the softness of a sofa or the hardness of a seat. And then even other things that are experienced on our skin, such as temperature or even humidity. These are all surface sensory experiences that are part of how we are understanding an environment. They're also part of kind of thinking when one of the objectives we have in workplace design is diversity and really making the space something that is not homogeneous. You might imagine a typical or traditional work environment where everything is beige, everything is the same temperature, everything, you know, has matching lighting condition. And we're really discovering that the human occupant experience wants something that might be much more equivalent to a walk in the park or a day out of doors or doing something that might come from more of a nature experience. And so you want to have some parts of your day that are in, you know, wide open, brightly lit space. You want to have some parts of your day that are in a more cloistered environment. And as designers, we can accentuate each of those experiences and increase that diversity through the materials that we're using and the textures of that, as well as the way we're operating our buildings from a temperature, humidity, and air exchange rate. So how fast are we moving air through a space and how is that impacting the experience? So again, you get to one of those points that's the sort of the intersection between how we design the environment on day one as architects or engineers, and then how do we operate that environment as either facilities managers or co-working community managers or operating companies of that space. So I think that's a fun intersection point and maybe one of the places we see the design evolving going forward.
Yeah, so much to think about. This is really interesting. So if I wanted to do kind of an audit of a space and maybe sort of using your kindergarten science, you know, sort of what sort of approach should I take to determine, you know, what's working, what's not working?
Yeah, so again, going back to people as the unit of analysis, first order of understanding is potentially going to be occupancy. Do you have the occupancy that you want, or are you looking for parts of your space to be more occupied? That's probably kind of a first order way of looking at things, and you can collect that information either through building systems information like sensors and badge swipe data, or simply by observing the space yourself. Anyone who travels a train might see, or even at a concert or a theater, you sometimes see a person with a little clicker that's just counting other people. So I think that the occupancy count is a good barometer and place to start. And then I think there's a range of tools. You know, we call it social research and people analytics for the built environment, but you can survey people, you can canvas people, you know, again, kind of like they might do at the mall. Can I ask you a couple questions about your experience today? You can, you know, just sit down and interview and get feedback. All of these are kind of anecdotal approaches. And then certainly a research or an engineering team such as ourselves to kind of come in and give you some of either the more quantitative perspective or more of the measured perspective, right? So what is your air exchange rate in the space? What is your current level of smell? What is your diversity of touch experience? What is the acoustical performance of the space? And again, thinking about the occupant, not only is the occupant more dialed into some of these things now, but a lot of these features can also be measured simply through an iPhone or Android device. A smartphone has already on it a light sensor, both for the screen brightness and for the camera. There's actually two light sensors on most devices. So that's actually something that could be used. Still, you'll need to know what to do about it from a design perspective.
Right.
but you can certainly start to quantify and get a baseline of what your current conditions are at a pretty amateur level,
yep.
But then kind of move that in a more scientific or design professional direction.
Yeah, I think this is just interesting on so many levels. I think the initial wave of co-working was often people who are sort of rebelling against, you know, sort of the corporate structure and setup and creating spaces that just were sort of anti that. And now there's so much to be thoughtful about and to figure out how to get that right and create good experiences, and some of which we can do on our own and some of which really will, you know, require some professional help, I think, to do a really good job and to do it up front. Before you kind of get into when your occupancy level is not good and you're trying to figure out what the problem is, you'd rather design that in, you know, right off the bat. So you get some of these things, you know, really nail some of these things and have some tweaks to do. But
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I say is, you know, a little bit of American history and my own background, but we've moved from an industrial era where we came out of factories and we went into offices, and the kind of best practice, so to speak, was to create an office that would offend no one. accommodate everyone. That accommodated also a lot of equipment. A lot of the shape of space was built not around people, but around equipment. Even to this day, we still have, you know, furniture systems and linear planning by and large to bring electricity to various places within the office in a relatively visually seamless way. And, you know, we're just moving away from that model of designing space that imagines that the human is also a machine to space that is really human-centric, that it's built on the science of understanding how we operate, what that human operating system is, and then really how to amplify it and how to help people work at their best within the environment. So I really think it's a golden age of being able to design a workplace for people and for communities of people and for organizations that are based on our talent being the basis of our profitability as a company. And so I think it's such an exciting time for these things that are so important to folks like us.
Perfectly said. The golden age. It's a good time to be in workplace. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective and your framework with us today. I learned a ton, and we'll include lots of notes in the show notes from what Melissa shared. And I can link also to the presentation from Juicy, which also shares the framework in a visual way, which is helpful. So thanks again for sharing today. And I look forward to, well, I think I'll see you next week, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Travel safely.
Yep. And Melissa, if we want to find you online, where can we find you?
Yeah, so we tweet from @Plastark, and that's kind of one of our primary focuses. Then we also run a number of meetups. If you're in the New York area, we've got Transforming Architectural Practice, which is one. We've got Building Community, which is another, that is about the intersection of community management and facilities management. Mm. And then we have also recently founded a social science committee of the AIA, which is the Architectural Professional Organization here in New York. So that's our events program. And then, of course, our website is plastark.com. And we're always keen to connect.
Perfect. Thank you. I wish I was in New York for those meetups. They sound great. Awesome.
Yeah, we'll give those links for the notes.
Yes, exactly. Perfect. Thank you. And have a great rest of your day.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.